When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to WWD Voices. My name is Arthur Zakowitz, executive editor of WWD, and today we have a special guest from our sister publication, Sourcing Journal. We have Pete Sidera, who's the editor in chief. Is that correct? Is that the right title?
That is accurate.
Okay. So tell us, what is Sourcing Journal, or SJ as it's known in the halls of Fairchild Media Group?
Well, first I want to say thanks so much for having me. I was thinking this morning before coming onto the call that we've probably known each other like two decades at this point. So it's we have a lot of professional and personal interest in common. So it's great to have the opportunity to talk with you. Sourcing Journal has been around since 2009. And in that time period, we've become the premier B2B publication for everything from raw materials and textiles, fashion, apparel, sourcing, shipping, logistics, and the sustainability communities. In-house, we like to say from dirt to shirt. So everything from sourcing the material to make a garment to the final mile when it gets to the end user is under the purview of Sourcing Journal.
And I know, you know, there is a little crossover of readership between Sourcing Journal and WWD, but how would you typically describe your readership?
Yeah, I would agree. There is some crossover, particularly with the fashion and apparel, and retail is a big part of our thing. Our readership spans everything from CEOs and CFOs to chief supply chain officers, chief sustainability officers. We're a little bit less consumer focused than our sister publication at WWD, but we have a very strong subscriber base and a very devoted readership. The industry really trusts us to deliver them the news they need to know, and that really is our calling card. Of course, brands, manufacturers, particularly buyers and merchants, are very interested in our coverage, and they make up a large share of our audience as well.
So you guys, very dedicated audience, and I've met some of them at your events. How many events do you guys do throughout the year? What's coming up?
So typically, we have been doing two events a year, our annual Sustainability Summit and what we call the Super Bowl of Sourcing in November, which is really the premier industry event for the sourcing industry. This year, we've also added an event, a sustainability event in California. So we'll be going there for the first time in September. A large part of that industry, particularly the denim industry, is located there. So we're looking forward to bringing that event out west. The next event coming up will be in a week, basically. It's March 26th, the annual Sustainability Summit. This year, it's called The Need for Radical Cooperation. And it's really a day of learning about how we can all band together to make the change that we feel is necessary.
So how would you describe like the current state of sourcing? And what are some of the challenges that retailers and brands and sourcing agents and everybody else involved?
Yeah, that's a good two-part question. The sourcing landscape has really never been more complicated, more complex. There's new obstacles popping up on a daily basis. The days of just finding the best garment at the best price, I think that's long behind us. You have to navigate endless geopolitical uncertainty, new legislation, tariffs, plus all the difficulties we had during COVID and in the time since, just simply getting goods to the end user from a transportation standpoint. So the equation, or the matrix, as you call, it's really getting very complex, and it takes a lot of deep thought and understanding of how this process works to really do your job well. Now, from challenges, what I will also say before I get to the challenges is that it is a very exciting time in the industry. We've become a much more environmentally conscious industry, a lot greener, and there's a lot of innovation that comes along with that has been very exciting. Also, new technologies have had a radical impact on everything from the design process to inventory management to the final mile. So there's a lot to follow and a lot to get excited about. AI is something we're covering in depth on Sourcing Journal. the way that this job was done in, you know, the 70s and the way it's done today, don't even, you can't even compare the two. So that, that change, that evolution is really exciting. But the challenge,
no more sharp pencils and Excel sheets, I guess.
No, I think the pad and pencil, that is a joke in house, the pad and pencil and the buyers using Excel spreadsheets, those are becoming relics of our past, but also our industry's past.
So the challenge is, I cut you off, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm a little long-winded apparently, but the challenge is, strangely, I really feel like they start with consumer uncertainty, the same as the audience at Women's Wear Daily would be facing. It makes everything very difficult. The more that you can plan and the more that you can look ahead to what to expect, the easier things are in many ways. Right now, people don't know what to expect 6 months from now. We were all expecting a recession. That didn't really happen. Then we had inflation. We didn't know how bad it would be or how quickly it would resolve. So when you have a situation like that and you're working in that environment, people are tentative. So the buyers are ordering closer to need and in less quantities and then chasing the goods. Well, that's not simple for them, but it's also very difficult for the manufacturers. How much staffing do they need? How much raw materials do they need? And when all of that's in flux, it creates a very unsteady environment for the sourcing industry. That's macro. When you get to more like micro, the main challenge is the key sourcing locales in Southeast Asia are facing big labor problems. There's a lot of minimum wage change coming. And on one side, it is progress that the minimum wage is changing. But on the local market, they're feeling it's not enough. So you have protests. You have a very unsettled environment there. On a more recent basis, big challenge, both of the canals, the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, are facing big problems for very different reasons. With the attacks in the Red Sea, people are looking for different ways to get goods here. So when we're talking about sourcing, you're talking about getting your product to where it needs to be. When you shut down the access to a major waterway like that, the ramifications are huge. And then we've been talking a lot about sustainability. The Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, it has low water levels due to the reservoir not getting as much water as it has in the past. That's a problem right now. It's easing slightly and they're opening more transports, but that's a problem that's not going away. And that's a big part of our industry, is how climate change will ultimately affect all of our sourcing from those countries in Southeast Asia that might have more damage as environment changes, to very concrete things like the Panama Canal not having enough water for people to go through it during off-peak times and peak times of the season.
Speaking of shutdowns, I saw a scary headline that re-traumatized me. Do we expect a shutdown on the West Coast and East Coast ports?
Among my list of challenges. So last year we had negotiations at the West Coast ports with the Dock Workers Union. These things typically drag on, and that required like presidential intervention and mediators to come in to ultimately settle it. That was the West Coast. Now we have the East Coast. Like, ironically, when the West Coast was having problems, the East Coast did become a more viable alternative and a more popular alternative. So the volume at the East Coast ports now is much higher than it's ever been. And their contract comes up in the fall, and they're already planting their stakes in the ground that this is going to be a difficult negotiation. So we just went through this last year. It seems like we're going through it again. Trade groups have already asked the administration to get involved and start pushing them along. But to say the negotiations are nations would be an understatement. They're barely begun, and there's a lot to be done to get to an agreement before that time, before October. And the workers have already expressed a willingness to strike if necessary. Now, October is not, people think that's when the holiday season goods come in. It's a little bit earlier than that, but you can't really, it would be a bad thing all around. So it's a good challenge to look forward to prepare for now, how you would navigate that were it to come to pass.
You know, speaking of like policy and the administration, this is an election year, and it usually disrupts everything, every aspect. People become more cautious on the spending, or they're not sure. Investments sort of kind of get wonky. Are you seeing that already now, or what's happening on that front?
The bigger issues with us is with the sourcing industry is that there's the whole way of procuring goods has changed with legislation over the last 10 years with transparency rules and things in the U.S. like the Forced Labor Protection Act, the UFLPA. You now need to not only prove that you have to prove the genesis of where your raw materials are coming from to ship them into this country, and certain parts of the world are on a no-fly list in that sense. But you also need to prove that it was not made with forced labor. So you have to have transparency through your entire supply chain, and it has to be provable and documentable. And that's really changed. With the election year, one topic that both sides of the aisle agree on is kind of an anti-China stance, which is where a lot of these problems come from. So it's a very popular side to take, whether it's the de minimis loophole that we have a lot of. Well, it's not a loophole, but the de minimis, they're calling it a loophole. Whether it's de minimis that's in the headlines a lot, or it's the China tariffs that were first installed by Trump that Biden hasn't changed. Tough talk on China is like a very popular stance. So when we go toward the election, I expect to hear a lot more of that, which if that's one of your key sourcing locales, which for everyone it is, despite some diversification, it gives you trepidation into how to proceed.
So with all these kind of moving parts and unpredictable disruptions and predictable disruptions, how do you forecast in this environment? How do you hedge against things that you're not certain of?
Yeah, that's why I'm a lot more comfortable writing about it than actively doing it for a living, because I can respond to how people are reacting. Really safeguarding yourself, diversification. So the two things that are like top of mind in our industry right now are know your supply chain. Like, it's no longer enough to have a tier one supplier, let them subcontract everything, and then not know where those goods are actually being made. You need to very much know your entire supply chain and have transparency. Also, it's not a lot of eggs in one basket situation. I would say 10 years ago, a lot of people had 85% of their sourcing coming from China. That I don't think anyone would really be anybody of scale would be operating like that now. The issue though is, there's no safe haven, if you want to call it that. There's geopolitical uncertainty everywhere. There's labor issues everywhere. There's potential forced labor in many countries. So it's not that you can just say, it's also difficult to move your entire operations. Like, to go to a new country where you're not currently operating is not a simple task. So most of the big players are already, I think China plus one was the catchphrase half a decade ago, and it's starting to take effect. It's really starting to, people are the reliance on China has gotten less. It's still a major player, but as the headline showed this year, it was the first time in over a decade that they weren't the number one importer to the U.S. It was Mexico this year, not as much for apparel and our industry, but as an overall imports. And that's basically the strategy. Diversify. Not that Myanmar was a giant sourcing location, but it was part of the industry. When they had problems with their military junta 18, 24 months ago, that hurt your sourcing there. So that can't be the only place you're located. So trying to hedge your bets with as much coverage as possible, it really seems to be the only way that you can plan or forecast for these things.
And so Mexico is nearshoring. That's nearshoring, correct?
Yeah. So it's an excellent point. One of the biggest news items for the last 24 months for me personally was nearshoring taking hold. As long as I've been in this industry, it's been the talk. It's been, we're going to nearshore, not so much made in USA, but CAFTA, DR, that actually, the data is now showing that that's actually taking effect. As I said, it's a little bit slower on the apparel and textiles part, but if we are making a push there, it's one of the only places that's seeing their market share drastically increase every 6 months, every year. It's getting bigger and bigger. So nearshoring is definitely here to stay. A lot of that was a response to the pandemic when goods were stuck that you couldn't get them. So not saying we'd have another pandemic, but if you can drive your goods somewhere versus put them on a boat for 21 days, it is a little bit better. Also, as I said earlier, dealing with uncertainty, the closer you are to the end consumer is a big deal. If you're chasing styles and you're chasing product, if you can get that from the factory to the shelves in 3 days without using a plane, that's much more attractive than having your suppliers, you know, a half a world away from the end consumer.
That, you know, the way you described that, during the pandemic, I kept having this vision of it, and I forget the name of the film, but it was there was a truck and it was full of explosives crossing a South American, you know, landscape, and the bridge was like shaky. And that always, that image from that scene in the movie, which I forget, always reminds me that it's doable. You can do it, but, you know, again, like you said, you have to be prepared. You have to have a strategy also behind it, and you got to like be quick to act, which I think COVID taught us, right?
Yeah, one of the biggest takeaways from COVID is that nearshoring is a reasonable alternative to shipping across the country. There's also price pays at the end of the day. So right. You're not going to pay 10 times as much to do things close to home versus getting the search for the cheapest needle. It's another industry phrase, and basically how you can get it made in the most cost-effective manner. It's become more cost effective to nearshore. Getting the raw materials has been easier. So your inputs are not being shipped across. The part of the problem people have with leaving China is if your inputs are in China, but you want to use a factory in South America, that doesn't really help. So you need to be able to have the raw materials local as well. And that's changing. I would also say that I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it's the first time in the 2 decades I've been in this business that I do start seeing a little bit more made in USA, which is the ultimate nearshoring for the American consumer. It does seem that, like, when you look at things like the solar industry or the electric vehicle industry, a lot of the way they've gotten to a point of price parity now is through incentives. So these things are not cost effective when they're first hitting the market, but over time with incentives, they're given the time to be made more cost effective. There is a potential where made in the USA could become a not exorbitantly expensive thing if the incentives line up to make businesses want to do that. And I do think we're starting to see some of that again.
So you guys have a new report that just came out. I guess it's State of Industry, right?
State of the Industry, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what were some of the key findings? What did you learn? What were the important takeaways that are coming out?
So thank you for pitching that. And it can be downloaded on sourcingjournal.com with the reports tab. But we do these State of Industry reports 8 times a year on different topics, from sourcing, which is our biggest one, obviously being Sourcing Journal, sustainability, logistics, raw materials. So we recently published our State of the Industry Sourcing Report. One of the main things we took a close look at is the buyer-supplier relationship. It's been a big topic in our industry since the pandemic. Although we're now 4 years away, just this conversation is illuminating how much of an effect that had on the industry, because so many of the decisions and patterns we have now spawned out of that. But during the pandemic, a lot of Western buyers just canceled orders with no remuneration to their suppliers, which left them in a bad spot. And it really highlighted the imbalance between that relationship, that it wasn't a partnership. It was kind of like an AB relationship. That hasn't really gone away. So we take a look at some groups that are trying to negotiate a better work environment between the buyers and the suppliers, from a contractual standpoint or from a true partnership standpoint. We mentioned nearshoring. We took a look at what Mexico is doing to bring in more apparel and textile. That was interesting. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the China plus one, the plus ones are running out of options too now. Everyone's been in Vietnam, is in Bangladesh, is in India, Indonesia. So what's next? We have a big feature on the Africa opportunity. They're really trying to take some market share from people. They have a huge labor pool, very easy to work there. There is one caveat that AGOA, which is the trade agreement that goods can come without tariffs, is expiring next year. And during the presidential year this year, it's going to be difficult to get that renewed. But if that is still a viable trade vehicle, there is a there that might be one of the new places people are going. So we took a deep dive to understand what works there, what doesn't, who's having success there, who isn't.
Cool. Oh, I remember the name of the movie. And if you check your email, I shot you a screenshot of it. It was called Sorcerer. And the image is hilarious. I think you should use it for your next sourcing report.
That's good. I'll get a but that definitely looks like that's what I think of in the sourcing industry now. Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's like what I think about when I think about sourcing from South America. So just one last question. In broad terms, because you've covered a lot right now, how did COVID change, the pandemic change sourcing its processes in permanent ways? And how is it going to evolve from here? How do you see the industry evolving in this post-pandemic period?
Yeah, that's a good question. How did it change us permanently? I think the biggest change to the sourcing industry from the pandemic is that it became like a backroom function of most companies to somebody that was sitting at the executive table, because the sourcing arm of most companies operated in the background, and it wasn't part of the M&A discussions or the logistics discussions or the strategical planning of a company. Now those people are at that table, because we found that without the goods to sell or be able to make them, you don't have a business. So it really elevated our industry. I mean, just simply our traffic on Sourcing Journal, just anecdotally, is 10 times higher than it was before the pandemic. We've been covering sourcing since 2009, but all of a sudden, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Women's Wear Daily, you're covering sourcing, you're covering logistics, because it's become, people really, it's always been important, but that importance has been recognized. So I'll say that was a big change from the pandemic, but also having multiple plans and multiple contingencies. I assume during the group, when things are going great, very few people are making backup plans. You kind of want to lean into what's working. And I would say that the fashion and apparel industry is some of the worst offenders of that. When things are going well and the consumer's spending, they're ordering a ton, they're buying, they have inventory on the way. And then when that dries up, we end up having markdowns, and we just repeat this process and this ebb and flow over and over. But the idea from a sourcing standpoint to having backup plans for how to get goods, for managing your inventory, people are working on those all the time now. Although it does seem like since the pandemic, it's just been one problem after another. Like whether it was the war with Russia and Ukraine, whether it's the canal problems, I can't think of a period of like 6 weeks where it's like, oh, everything's just going smoothly. Container prices have been on a seesaw. They went to 10,000, then they went back down to 1,000, then they're back up to 4,000. So planning, I often say when I talk to the experts in the industry that I try to get information from, I just don't know how you guys can plan for anything over any long period of time, because the near term keeps shifting so quickly. So I would say having a greater voice in the companies they work for has been a long-term change. And the art of the contingency plan and the necessity to having a plan B, C, D, and E at all times really have altered our jobs.
You got to stay awake. I think, as a by way of metaphor, the Chinese soldiers, that they lead guards, they put little pins in their collars. So if they're nodding off, they get stuck by the pin. We sort of need that.
We've been wearing a collar of pins for 48 months now. Yeah.
He's crazy. All right. Pete, thank you so much for joining us today. Listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Thanks,
Art.